Next up on This Week in Law, Mike Keyes and Emery Roan are with me, and Scott Refsland, the chairman of the Drone Sports Association, comes by to talk about the FAA and drone sports. We're also going to delve into the EU requiring due diligence before linking. Do longer tweets affect copyrightability? Can YouTube fix content ID? And when a pet drone and a pet eagle square off, who wins? All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill. This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Emery Roan. Episode 360, recorded September 16th, 2016. Miniature UAV, you complete me. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/twill. to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/twill. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and welcome to This Week in Law. If you're a regular listener, welcome back. If you're not, we're so glad that you've joined us. This is where we get together every Friday is when we record the show to discuss all the very, very interesting issues at the intersection of technology and law. To tell you what's caught our eyes this week, what folks have sent us that's caught their eyes. And we usually have a very interesting guest this week. Should be no exception. We have our fingers crossed that everything works out. We're going to attempt to bring in Scott Refsland, who is the chairman of the Drone Sports Association, a little bit later on in the show. He had some business to take care of at the top of the show here, so we're going to start without him and hopefully bring him in. Ah, there is where they held the Drone Worlds. If you're watching the video, you can see the lovely picture from Hawaii. Where they held the Drone Racing World Championships recently and was covered by ESPN. So if you're interested in seeing the Drone Nationals or the Drone Worlds, you can find footage of those events, one of which I attended, on ESPN. And it's well worth looking into if you're interested. So before we get around to talking with Scott, and I definitely have my fingers crossed that that works out, my wonderful co-hosts are here with me, and I'd love for you to welcome them. Emery Roan is here. He is a third-year law student at California Western School of Law in San Diego. Hi, Emery.
Hey, Denise. Thanks for having me on the show, as usual. Looking forward to it, and thank you for all you listeners and viewers for tuning in and catching us.
Absolutely. Also joining us is Mike Keyes from Seattle, Washington, where he is a partner with the Dorsey firm. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Hello, Emery. Great to be with both of you, as always.
Great to see you, too. All right, we're going to get right into it because we have a bunch of stuff to cover that we're hoping to get through before we bring in Scott. So we're going to start with copyright. We wanted to bring to your attention a case out of the EU. We're not just bringing it to your attention because it salaciously involves Playboy and pictures that Playboy published and not just Playboy.
Well, we're not just bringing it to you because it's salacious.
Oh, yes. This is not the only reason that we are bringing it to you, though I'm sure that there are those of you who
factored into it.
A particularly interesting case because it does involve naughty pictures. And those naughty pictures were the basis of a lawsuit in the EU that was decided by the EU court that had an interesting impact from the copyright standpoint. And what that case held was that hyperlinks to, in this case, naughty pictures belonging to Playboy that were published without Playboy's consent. So someone had gotten hold of a number of these pictures and was making them available for download. There was a media company, and I haven't looked too deeply into what exactly this media company was doing or what its reason for publishing links to the images available for download was. And so hopefully Emery and Mike can shed a bit more light on that. But they were publishing these links to the infringing material. And the court seemed to view them through the same kind of lens that you would view a search engine that solely existed to connect you up with torrents or something that you, you know, have no business accessing to begin with. That there seemed to be this sense from the court, from the coverage I've read of this case, that the party in question, this media company, was capitalizing on the fact that this unauthorized material was available out there, and by pointing people toward that unauthorized material, that was somehow assisting their business. The court didn't like that and has now imposed a duty that I think is going to be kind of hard for people to navigate, to ascertain whether or not the material that you are linking to is authorized to be on the web by the rights holder who owns it. There are some distinctions in the case here as to whether linker in question is engaged in a for-profit activity or not. The court draws some lines based on that. It also creates what sounds like its own sort of DMCA regime, its own notice and takedown regime, that whereby it doesn't matter if the activity of the linker is for profit or nonprofit, if the rights holder goes ahead and contacts them and lets them know, hey, that's our material you're linking to, it's not authorized on the web, take down the link, then they have an obligation to do that. So the one takeaway that I get from your colleague, Mike, who wrote this up at the TMCA, your firm's blog, is this overarching statement at the end that the EU court has been known to reverse itself on things. So it's what he writes is, it's entirely possible that the law might change once again the next time this issue comes before the court. So who knows how long these standards are going to be in place. But this seems to be how the EU is treating this issue for the time being. And it's important not just to those in the EU, but those doing business in the EU. And that's a whole lot of folks. So, Mike, I'm going to kick it to you to fill in some gaps here about this decision. What can you add?
Sure. No, on your last point, I think you're right. As I understand it, stare decisis, which we value here in U.S. jurisprudence, isn't necessarily something that it holds the same amount of sway for the U.K. Legal system. So, yes, it's entirely possible that this could be reversed or significantly limited or modified the next time this comes before the court. So this result is considerably different than what we would likely see here in a U.S. court. There's been a number of cases, particularly in the 90s and the early 2000s, dealing with the concept of linking and whether providing a hyperlink to infringing material could be considered contributory infringement, because you're not, as the party that's providing the link, you're not the party that engaged in the direct act of infringement. The argument would be you're engaging in contributory infringement. And there's been a number of cases over the years, but ultimately where, by and large, where courts in the U.S. have come down on the issue is, look, hyperlinks are essentially guideposts or roadmaps, if you want to use something in the tangible world. It's essentially driving directions to a certain location. And you can't be considered an infringer under our copyright laws here in the U.S. for providing, quote-unquote, driving instructions to a third party. significantly different result is what we see here as a result of the UK decision. You can be an infringer under the UK court, the highest court's most recent decision, by simply providing the link. Now, as you noted, there is the whole concept of if you provided this link or knowing or you should have known that it wasn't authorized by the copyright holder, that can lead to liability. But of course, it raises the fundamental question of how can you possibly track down that information in the context of the World Wide Web as to whether content that's residing on a site is authorized to be there by the copyright holder. It almost imposes an impossible standard to comply mm-hmm. with or to really to analyze when you're deciding whether a link can be placed to content online. So the decision raises probably more questions than it does answers, at least in terms of when liability will ultimately flow to that linking party.
Mm-hmm. And you, just to clarify, Mike, you've said a couple of times the UK. Are you meaning to say that or the EU?
I'm sorry,
I thought
EU.
This was the Court of Justice of the EU.
You're exactly right. I apologize. I'm thinking of
with
some
Brexit
other,
and all. I don't know that we
right,
can
right,
equate
right.
them anymore.
Thank you. Thank
you're
you.
Welcome.
Yes, I meant EU.
Great. All right. The other thing that I had a couple of sort of what reactions to this decision based on the law that you mentioned, Mike, here in the U.S. where courts over and over again have declined to impose liability for the mere act of linking. It's not that that's a completely cut and dried issue in the U.S. I definitely have seen that we've had courts that have struggled with this same kind of, we're not going to let people profit off of illegal or infringing activities. So there is this sort of desire to impose good behavior, but no court in the U.S. has gone as far as this court seems to have gone in imposing this sort of due diligence responsibility of finding out, this stuff we're linking to, was it authorized by the rights holder? Was it legally published or not? So that seems like a really difficult standard and one that doesn't really take into account. Again, I'm not real sure what this media company was up to and their purpose for publishing the works. But I think about entities like Torrent Freak here in the U.S. who report on the world of download and infringing activities and provide a lot of good information about those phenomena. And I would hate to see someone like Torrent Freak run afoul of a standard like this. It also seems like the other sort of very large shoe that remains to drop here is the role of search, legitimate search, and what sort of mm-hmm. obligations are going to be on search entities to comply with this standard. I think those are all open questions at this point. Mm-hmm. Also, another sort of footnote open question that comes up time and time mm-hmm. again is this distinction between profit and not-for-profit activity and the fact that as soon as you hang an ad on a blog post, I think someone might be able to convincingly argue that that has gone from being an informational activity to a profit-based activity. So another little wrinkle in the mix there. Emery, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I have that much to add. I think that it sounds like it's an unworkable burden to put on the website. And I was just sort of going back through my head. Obviously, we talked about how this is essentially settled law here in America after, Perfect 10 v. Google basically said that, hyperlinks are signposts. They're not actually like distributions. But, I am not as familiar with European copyright law. I don't know. This doesn't sound rather that it is that unexpected to come out of a European court. It sounds like it conforms more to like the, rights of the author. And, they seem to be more okay with the idea that I don't know. I am still trying to wrap my mind around this, to be honest. So, yeah.
Right. And the qualifier that you just put on yourself, we should put on all of us. None of the three of us are European lawyers or familiar with the EU and the way, you know, the ins and outs of its enforcement of copyright laws. So we're just trying to take this in as a thing that happened and try and make some guesses about how it's going to affect people, not just in the EU, but beyond. Mike, any further thoughts?
Well, I have a quick question for you guys.
Oh, sure.
Do either of you know if the five rights conferred by copyright are the same under European copyright law? Is it how identical are our copyright standards?
I really couldn't tell you. You know, I've never practiced law in the EU. I've never tried to enforce a copyright there or register a copyright there. Mike, any light you can shed?
Yeah, I really don't have much insight as to that issue, the exclusive rights provided under the EU laws with respect to these sorts of issues. I did want to point out one thing, though, as we were mentioning at the top of the show, this is really a secondary copyright liability scheme, or at least we talk about this sort of issue being a secondary copyright infringement claim, because as the linker or as somebody that's providing access to the content, you are not the direct infringer. You're not the party that placed the infringing content on that particular site. There is liability. I don't want people to think that, you know, it's a total free-for-all when it comes to secondary copyright liability in the U.S. Of course, there's the seminal 2005 decision, the Grokster case that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And of course, that was a secondary liability case. And the court said, look, if you are in the business of providing software and you know or have a very strong reason to know, suspicion to know that your software is going to be used for infringing purposes, that can lead to liability under our Copyright Act. So, but this is kind of one, if not many steps removed from the Grokster type of model where you have, it could be an innocent third party that provides a link to content that ultimately is infringing and therefore the linker is potentially on the hook. That's a fundamentally different issue than where we typically see secondary liability issues here under U.S. copyright law.
Were they, in this case, were they concerned with secondary liability, or was it the actual company was posting the hyperlinks to Playboy? I actually don't know that off the top of my head.
Yeah, Emery, that I don't know. I don't.
Because I was thinking, if it is like a third party, then it's almost like that. There is a European version of CDA Section 230, right? I feel like I know that, but again, I am also just shooting from the hip here about EU law that I probably shouldn't be. So. Feel free to correct us, listeners. Please tweet at me and tell me how wrong I am. I'd love to hear from you. Yes, you. Okay.
Yes. EU lawyers, enlighten us. Okay, the only other thing I wanted to say about this is it also sort of reminds me that there is this other line of cases in the United States that deals with liability around linking but doesn't invoke copyright. And I feel like they bear mention here. They really haven't come up lately. But back, in the wild and woolly early days of the internet, there were people who were attempting to create liability for deep linking to stuff not on your portal, if people remember what portals were, or not on your homepage, and were attempting to cobble together arguments about the burden that it put on your servers if you were linking to something past the front door of a site. There's this wacky case out there, Ticketmaster versus tickets.com. And then there was an eBay case as well that involved this doctrine called the trespass to chattels doctrine, which was asserted as a basis for saying, you're messing with my servers by linking to stuff that we're not. It's not that it wasn't publicly available. It's just that, in many cases, it's that it wasn't on the homepage. I think there have been cases that also involve stuff. There's a link there, but it's not a link that we publicize. So those cases are out there and can, I don't know that they've died a final death, but it doesn't seem like that issue has come up at all lately. And I don't, none of the coverage I've read of this EU case indicates that it came up here. Of course, it wasn't Playboy's servers that were implicated. The images had been stored somewhere else. So I don't know how relevant that is. But that's my last thought on it. Anything else, folks?
I've got nothing.
Nothing further here.
All right. Let's go ahead and thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. Our sponsors today are all about helping you make sure that the financial side of your life and your business are rolling along just as smoothly and wonderfully as you would like them to do and are staying out of your way. Everything's just working the way you want it, but not imposing a whole lot of time, effort, burden, taking you away from the important stuff that helps you make money and enjoy your money. And so our first sponsor is FreshBooks, and it is the super simple cloud accounting software that gives thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Small business owners, it's time to be honest about how you feel when you're dealing with your day-to-day administrative work. It's not what you're in it for, right? In fact, you probably can't stand it. It can be a total grind. The truth is, over 5 million small business owners felt exactly the same way until they discovered FreshBooks. FreshBooks is the dead simple cloud accounting software that's transforming how small business owners handle their paperwork. Using FreshBooks to create and send an invoice literally takes about 30 seconds. There are no formulas or formatting, just perfectly crafted invoices every time. You can also brand your invoices, so this is a very cohesive part of your business. You can set recurring invoices and attach receipts. Your clients can pay you online as well, which often means that you end up getting paid a whole lot faster. With FreshBooks, you can set auto payment reminders and snap photos of receipts. There's a super handy deposit feature, so you can also invoice for a payment upfront when you're kicking off a project. You can also import expenses automatically. FreshBooks can even show you whether or not a client has looked at the invoice you've emailed. So if you suspect your client is dragging his or her feet, and it really might mean that, you know, you need to have more dialogue with this client to make sure that there's not some issue with the work or whatever. You want to make sure that they're happy and they're going to pay you and there's no sort of brewing problem out there. You can at least tell whether they've read the invoice or not and then wait it a few weeks without getting in touch or paying you. This is only a fraction of what FreshBooks can do for you. You owe it to yourself to feel the full effect of FreshBooks on you and your small business. Also, check out their EMV chip card enabled card reader. Getting started is simple and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/twill and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. Guys, in just a few days, on September 19th, Twitter is going to slightly tweak its 140-character maximum requirement. This is going to, it appears, affect tweets that involve images, GIFs, polls, and videos. We're not sure, and I'm taking this from Corbin Davenport's report at The Verge, and Corbin's not sure whether that's going to go into effect over a gradual period. It is all set to start, though, on September 19th, and it means that if you've put... Sometimes what you can find happen on Twitter, and I'm sure everyone who uses the service has experienced that. I experience it every time we start the show, and I want to put in a link to where you can watch the show, and I want to put in the names of our guests and my wonderful co-hosts, and it takes up all the space in the tweet. And so I'm basically forced to shout out, come join us for Twill, and that's about all I can say. Now you're going to be able to say more stuff in tweets that involve other media that's taking up space, which raises the question, and this is why I put it in the show. We love to and have come back to the issue repeatedly on the show of whether tweets are copyrightable. So I'm just curious, guys, whether you think that longer tweets means more potential for copyrightability. What do you think, Mike?
Well, it's going to depend, I think, on how many more characters can be used. Do we have any insight into that, Denise?
No.
We just say it sounds like a cryptographer problem to say, like, how many combinations of words in the English language can you fit into a space of 190 characters, and how much more is it than 140 characters? You know, the issue of copyrightability of tweets, as we've talked about before, you know, comes down to, you know, the fact that in 140 characters, you usually can't rise to the level of creativeness that is necessary for something to be copyrightable. At least that's what courts have said in the past, I believe. But I actually, I don't know, when I first read this link in the article, I was very convinced on the one on that they are copyrightable. I mean, if, you know, we're talking about what rises to the level of creativity, usually that's a pretty low bar, according to, you know, the history of copyright law. And it seems like the, you know, the more restrict, I feel like frequently, you know, the most creativity comes out of, you know, the most restrictions you place on yourself. And so, you know, I think I've seen some very creative ways of fitting in what people want to say into 140 characters that, you know, I don't think is so generic that, you know, it's not copyrightable, considering that, you know, haikus are certainly copyrightable. You know, if you were, for example, to release a series of, you know, a triptych of tweets that were thematically connected, clearly that would rise to the level of creativity. So why can't you reduce that down to simply 140 characters? So I think obviously, you know, copyright attorneys are probably not going to say that tweets are never copyrightable, even at 140 characters. They could, you know, theoretically rise to the level of creativity necessary to be copyrighted. But in 190 characters, I think that, yeah, it seems certainly more likely that the amount of what could be copyrighted is, you know, grown.
Yeah, that was my thought too, that it will only enhance. I mean, there are probably people out there who would make the argument that's not copyrightable because it's too short, and then you'd have to come in and demonstrate exactly what you were saying, Emery,
that you can be very creative in a short.
Yes, exactly. Hashtags and trademarks. Right,
now
Mike?
That's
really more the issue there. I think it would just sort of enhance the copyrightability possibilities. And it also makes me think about text exchanges, which get screen capped and published because they're often hilarious or sad or, you know, whatever reason you share a text exchange and you can talk about.
Or recorded because the person deleted it and it's, you know, some kind of watchdog organization, you know?
Right. And I've never gone down this rat hole before, but I think it's an interesting one to play out with you guys since we're talking about it. How do you think taking a screen cap of a text exchange would fare in states where two-party consent is required to record a phone call or other, you know, audio? I don't know. I haven't seen that one come up.
I would think that my gut take on that is that it wouldn't be the two-party, you know, wiretapping issue, because I'm sure that, you know, you don't have like an expectation of privacy in your communications on Twitter, and it's not like you're.
No, I'm talking about texts now, SMS.
Literally screen capping text messages and then posting that on Twitter. Now that's a whole other issue.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there are copyrightability issues that come up there. You know, are you creating a joint work with someone? This is high in my mind because at some point before the show this morning, someone posted something hilarious to Facebook that was an exchange between a mom. I'll tell you what it was. You can look it up. It's really, really funny. It's hysterical, actually. But again, you know, I'm not just bringing it up because of the subject matter. Just want you to know this. It's how I got thinking about this subject this morning, is when you create something that is funny and becomes viral and can arguably be a profit center, you know, is it copyrightable? And I would think possibly so, although you could argue about the creativity that goes into having an exchange with someone you're just communicating with. Is it more of a sort of performance art at that point? But the subject matter was mom had sent her, I believe it was her 13-year-old daughter, into a drugstore looking for feminine supplies. And the exchange that took place was the daughter saying, I can't find them anywhere in the store. Anyway, they're nowhere. They don't exist. They're invisible. You know, they're not marked anywhere. And she was prowling up and down the aisles saying, Mom, they're not here. Yes, they're there. And it was sort of a life lesson for her that, you know, in fact, the mom had great glee in shooting back. Look for them by sort of the lube and sex. Sexually oriented materials on the shelf. And the daughter's like, Mom! Anyway, hysterical exchange made me think about whether something like that. There are many, many examples of hysterical text exchanges between people that get screen capped and published. So the copyrightability of that sprung to my mind, and also this issue of, you know, here it was the mom who posted it with great gusto to her own Facebook page. So one of the authors is who published it, but that might not necessarily always be the case. And as you point out, Emery, it might be of a conversation that someone might be thinking of, like a phone conversation that, you know, this is my one-on-one exchange with this person and I've never given consent for it to be screen capped or recorded, et cetera. I would think that the law would treat it differently and that the audio recording statutes wouldn't sweep this in, but I don't know that I have 100% certainty on that. What do you guys think?
So if I write a letter to someone, that letter is copyrighted automatically because it's, you know, rises above the minimum level of originality and creativity necessary, and it's fixed in a tangible medium and, you know, the intent behind it or whatever. I obviously would have the copyright on that. So I could see using a copyright defense to prevent people from distributing that. But I don't know if it's necessarily the same thing as the wiretap because, I mean, you're recording, you're consciously, intentionally recording your conversation and distributing it to the person. You know, it's very interesting, though. Text messages aren't necessarily the same thing directly, but I don't know.
Yeah, on the joint authorship issue, you raise an interesting point, Denise, because we typically think of joint authorship issues under the Copyright Act as two or more people coming together, each bringing copyrightable content with the intent that it be merged into a unitary whole. And therefore, they have joint authorship status with respect to that work. You know, I suppose the mother and daughter didn't intend that they were actually creating some sort of copyrightable work, but
no.
That in the process, though, you know, the law of unintended consequences, they did in fact have this. I haven't seen the exchange, but it does sound quite hilarious.
It is. Yeah. And there is this sort of sense as you read it that maybe both of them had in their mind, and maybe this is just me reading it in, but in today's day and age where moms would decide to post something like this on social media, that maybe both of them had in their mind, oh, This is a really funny chat that we're having, and they seem to be kind of building on that and saying things to each other that maybe they might not have said if it wasn't being written down and potentially screen capped and posted. So I kind of do get this performance art vibe from it as you read it. At one point, the girl makes a map, like scribbles out a graphic map of, you know, again, ironically showing you where you would find these products in the store. And again, you know, are people doing this for their own entertainment? Quite possibly, but it almost seemed like the two of them were conscious that there could be a greater audience. And so I wonder if that changes the copyright calculus at all. I don't know. Rat hole descended into, let's climb out unless you guys have any further thoughts.
Somebody in chat mentioned something about, well, wouldn't the work have to be registered before you did anything with it? Of course, under U.S. law, you automatically obtain copyright protection with respect to any work of authorship. You do not have to register it in order for you to have rights, copyright protection in that particular work. You have to register it with the U.S. Copyright Office in order to enforce your rights in federal court, and you get certain benefits associated with registering it, i.e. you can obtain attorney's fees and statutory damages if you've registered your work before the act of infringement. But remember, when it comes to copyright protection itself, you have it as soon as that work is fixed in a tangible medium of expression.
Right. I was just looking up. I'm not sure if the pictures themselves of the screen caps themselves were publicly posted by the mom. I don't know her name. I'm trying to give you a link of how you would find them. And I'm not sure the person who posted this made that a public post. So I will put it in the discussion points after the show. How about that for anyone who's not just out there anxiously Googling away? All right. From that very entertaining and lighthearted exchange to something a little bit more in the legal weeds, Stephen Levy at Back Channel did a very long read, interesting piece if you are interested in this kind of thing. Although at one point he writes in the piece, now don't fall asleep on me here. Do not yawn. Stick with me. He's writing about Carl Malamud, who, I believe we've had him on the show before. It's been a while, but I believe we've actually had Carl on the show. And if I'm misremembering that, I'm sure that we have discussed him a whole lot on the show. And he is the individual who has sort of made it his life's work to publicresource.org, I believe, is his site. And he is on a crusade, for lack of a better term, to make sure that people understand that legal authorities are the property of the public and should not be locked up and made inaccessible. And he's involved in at least a couple of lawsuits involving Public Resource having published states' codes. And folks who were involved in that publishing coming in and saying, no, you can't do that, or you can't do it in the way that you've done it because there are copyrighted elements to what you have published. So there was a discussion, possibly a hearing or a resolution at the American Bar Association recently that was known as Resolution 112, that is a proposed compromise on this issue, and Carl Malamud opposes it. So Stephen Levy explicates this in great detail in his piece. So I refer you there if you're interested in more on this. And I know that Emery has delved into it a bit deeper than I have. So Emery, what can you add?
I just, if you're at all interested in, open government or open access to the law or, expanding legal access, anything like that, I really encourage you to read this article. It's, I tweeted out right afterwards saying that, every now and then you need a motivational shot in the arm, and this did it for me. But so basically the long and short of it is, when, regulations are written, frequently they incorporate without including the standards that are frequently written by standards writing organizations, or standard developments organizations, excuse me. Now, these standard development organizations, even though the regulations themselves, since they're a government work, are public domain, because they incorporate the standards, the standards themselves should be public domain, you would think. But these standards drafting organizations that write them have been claiming copyright on them, and that's really how they base their business. They claim copyright on the standards that they write, and then they sell them to to make money. Now, Carl Malamud says, well, wait a minute, this is ridiculous. The law needs to be open. Everyone needs to be able to see the law, because otherwise, you're forced to pay thousands of dollars or however much just to access it. Now, this resolution 112, was supposed to be a compromise where the compromise was saying that, okay, we can any of these standards that are sort of incorporated must be available on the web for free viewing. Now, you would think that that would, solve the problem, but I think that Carl Malamud has a great reason for saying that that doesn't go far enough, because that still it doesn't say that they're in the public domain. It doesn't affirmatively state that there is no copyright or that the standards that are incorporated have to be, completely public domain. Instead, it just says that they have to be available on the web to be read. Now, Carl Malamud points out that means that, you can only read them on the internet. You can't distribute them. You can't convert them so that they're, able to be read by blind or, otherwise disabled people. And it, he really fixates on the idea that this is a core issue of democracy, that our laws fundamentally need to be able to be public. And I am right there with him. You know, this is I have stated before, I think, on the show that one of the like the rudest wake up calls to me when I started law school was realizing how powerful these gatekeepers are to legal knowledge. So you have things like LexisNexis and Westlaw that, you know, have a stranglehold on this business of legal research. And, you know, there's an argument to be made that, you know, they're curating this information that should be public. And so by curating it, you know, that adds value and they are okay then to, you know, charge access to it. I would disagree with that. But here it's, you know, much worse. This is simply their standards that are written by organizations that are then directly incorporated into the law. You know, it sounds ridiculous that they should have copyright at all. So go check out the article if you're interested in open access to the law. I highly recommend it. It's a very nice long read.
Yes.
But I should say that Resolution 112 passed. So there, you know, these standards are available in read-only format on the web, but the standard drafting organizations do maintain copyright on them. So go check it out. It's a good read.
Yeah, fascinating. An important evolution of how we can access or not access the laws that govern us all. You can find Stephen Levy's story and everything else we've discussed today at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. Episode 360 is the show that you want to look for there to find all our discussion points for today. Also, over on Flipboard, I'm trying to curate stuff for the show at flipboard.com/dhowell/thisweekinlaw. So if you have stuff you want to flip us on Flipboard or suggest we include in that magazine, please let us know there. That one tends to be more comprehensive than what we actually discuss on the show, and that might be great for you if you're interested in seeing everything we're sort of reading and paying attention to, even things that don't make the cut. That's where you're going to find those. Let us move on and talk about Content ID. And when we do so, we're still in the realm of copyright, but we're also moving into the realm of entertainment and Hollywood. Another thing that caught my eye just this last week is a piece at Fast Company, authored by John Paul Titlow. And it is basically discussing that Content ID, how it has evolved and how it is evolving. It is something that is complained about a lot, the common complaints are that it's overbroad and that things that aren't infringing get thrown off and that the rights holders wind up benefiting from the arrangement. The big rights holders wind up benefiting from the arrangement more than, say, the low budget video poster or zero budget video poster who happens to be using YouTube and perhaps posting a picture of their baby dancing to a Prince song. But it is a nice refresher as to how Content ID has evolved and is evolving. One kind of point is that at first, if there was revenue to be gotten from something that Content ID had flagged, at first that revenue was shunted over to the rights holders' side of the equation. Now it is held in limbo, sort of in escrow, until the dispute between the rights holder and the poster gets resolved. And there's also discussion too of making Content ID more accurate so that it can determine whether something is actually an infringing piece or not. What we can't do, what it can't do, what Google can't do, really is have all the nuance of understanding how fair use works and looking at a video and going, yes, that is something that Content ID has flagged as something that is copyright held by another, but we're looking at that and we think that it's probably fair use, so it's going to stay up. Content ID hasn't gone that far, is not likely to go that far, although courts are grappling with making rights holders go down that road, and we've talked about that before on the show with the Lens case.
I think there's something interesting to be said here about, you know, the idea of maybe. All right. So this article was talking specifically about how Content ID is being improved by Google incorporating Content ID with Google Brain, their like neural networks project that they're working on as well. And they're saying that, you know, through this neural network, these AI, basically Content ID is just getting much, much more accurate and, you know, slowly but surely, you know, getting rid of those problem areas. Now, I agree wholeheartedly that, you know, right now it's incapable of making those decisions on fair use, because fair use is super complex and, you know, it's hard for lawyers. It's impossible for lawyers to make a definitive 100% statement that something is fair use after all. You know, that's has to be decided by the courts. And that's not necessarily easy to predict. What sort of interests me, though, is the idea that this Content ID system is a direct response to the DMCA and the demands that a service like YouTube would have to comply with the DMCA. Excuse me. And, okay, so let's, you know, theoretically think about what the situation could be if Google actually could perfect whatever, and perfecting is in air quotes for my listeners, perfect Content ID so that it could even recognize fair use. Does that, you know, put it in the situation where only companies, only web services that have access to neural nets and have access to Google resources are able to effectively deal with the demands of the DMCA? And what does that mean for how, you know, its own efficacy and its role in, you know, 2016 internet? But that's, you know.
Right.
A bit of a,
yeah, it's an excellent point. Right, so if you're a startup video hosting service and you do not have a advanced AI product that you're able to bring to the table. One of the things the article points out that Google Brain can help with is figuring out when people have sort of doctored up the video in an effort to evade Content ID. Sometimes people use visual tricks. This is from the article. Like horizontally flipping videos, changing their aspect ratio, warping the audio, or adding a bright halo effect to the center of the clip. So Google Brain can try and sort of flag when find the identified contact, even though something like that has been employed. So it's getting smarter, but I could definitely see where, you know, there could be false positives. Using that as well. Mike, any thoughts?
Nothing further from here. Really interesting article, though.
Yes. So we recommend that one to you if you want to know more about what's going on with Content ID, where it's been, and where it's going. In the meantime, let's go on to a different story, this time involving Facebook, the social web, and privacy. So back to the EU now. Here we're at a court in Belfast, Ireland, where Facebook was attempting to say that it shouldn't be capable of being sued by a 14-year-old girl who had a naked picture of her. God, we're all about the naked pictures today, and this is not as lighthearted or in any means as authorized as some of the as one of the others that we discussed earlier, that was posted on a shame page and in a revenge kind of context. The girl wants to sue Facebook for misuse of private information, negligence, and breach of the Data Protection Act. And she's going to be able to do that, according to the court in Belfast. Emery, what more can you tell us about this?
I wish I could add more. I think that I pointed this out. We have, you know, two articles from the EU about privacy concerns. You know, I think that it, again, sort of reflects that difference between the American courts and the European courts. As I understood it, this would be pretty much, you know, closed book case of Section 230 of the CDA in here. Do either of you guys disagree that Facebook, you know, wouldn't be liable for that?
Here in the U.S.
I think you're right. It does seem
so. I mean,
covered by
I just think that, you know, we brought up a couple of differences earlier about the, you know, difference between EU and U.S. copyright. You know, this is another case that sort of highlights the EU-U.S. divide in privacy law. I just think it's very interesting to keep those differences in mind, that our own regimes aren't necessarily universal values. And that doesn't make it any more or less correct. I think that obviously CDA 230 is hugely important for the the survivability of the internet. But at the same time, these cases have merit, and European courts are able to rule however they'd like. I'm definitely going to be following it. I think it's very interesting.
Another fascinating case, this time from Austria. And this one just makes you scratch your head and go, how does something ever get to the point where people in this kind of relationship with one another are suing each other over this issue? But
so this is an 18-year-old Austrian girl suing her parents for posting photographs on their Facebook page of her throughout her childhood. And so they have shared, over 500 photographs of her from, baby, from her, youngest days, as she was having her diaper changed or sitting on the toilet being potty trained. And these, photos that she considers incredibly embarrassing and did not consent to the sharing of these photos with, her parents' 700 Facebook friends. I wish this girl the best of luck. I think that this is a really interesting case to follow. I said that before, how much it weirds me out seeing, I've seen people on Facebook post sonograms of their children so that their children are on Facebook before they can breathe their first breath. This is very weird world that we are finding ourselves in. The rights of the children to control, how they're being put on Facebook against their will. Good on you.
Right. I mean, you would think that simply having a discussion with the parents would be enough to deal with this issue, but apparently not. She has asked that her parents take down the pictures. They have refused, and she has therefore sued. So I've got to think that relationships between this 18-year-old and her parents are probably at an all-time low at this point. Mm-hmm. And, I just hope their family manages to get it together. I think This is probably a fringe kind of case, because I can't imagine that, even though we live in an interesting time and people are putting things online that their better judgment might encourage them not to, maybe getting back to the exchange with the 13-year-old, is she embarrassed that she had this exchange with her mom that her mom decided to post? Did mom get permission? I sure hope so.
Facebook and these services, they don't let children use their services according to their UOs, children are not supposed to be using these services, and yet parents can, post photographs of their children. And I think there's an interesting privacy concern there. Where are the children consenting to having all their baby pictures, thrown up on Instagram and Facebook? And can they then choose to get those taken down afterwards? And what happens if they don't? So this is, again, an EU court. I'm sure that there are American kids that are having this issue as well. So we'll see if anything, pops up here.
Right. Mike, any thoughts about either of these cases?
No, nothing further.
Okay. Let's see. Then I think we have time. I believe the studio is attempting to connect us up with Scott Refsland, and we will let you know when that happens and bring him in. But until then, I want to look at a trademark story that was posted on Mike's firm's blog, thetmca.com, that is really interesting and pretty funny. I need a clarification here, Mike, first from the pop culture standpoint as opposed to the legal standpoint, because I always thought maybe this is another basis for a separate trademark claim, that when you're sort of burying your face in your elbow and the other arm flies out, that you're hitting the dab. But no, apparently this is now known as the bolt after athlete. How do we say his name? Usain?
Usain?
Yes, Bolt, the world's fastest man, multiple Olympic medal winner at the recent Rio Olympics. So bolting is different than dabbing?
I think you're right. I think it's a variation on dabbing. I guess when you're bolting, you're taking more of a, I don't know, angle towards the sky, as I understand it, opposed to what you just said. So, yes, I do believe technically there is a distinction between the two.
All right. And maybe because dabbing comes from a football player whose name escapes me, I think. No?
Oh.
Not a
I don't know. I've never heard of that phrase.
You know, obviously.
In that context, at least.
Emery and I are not the people you should consult on football issues. Dabbing has to do with drugs, someone's telling me in IRC. All right. I clearly have some research to do after the show. I'm unaware of its origins, but it just looks similar to me. All right. Having gone down there, let me see. Scott is good and ready. So can we... hold on to this thought and get back to dabbing when we're ready to wrap up the show and after we've talked a bit about drone racing. Is that okay?
Sounds great.
All right, good. Then I'd like to introduce to you all Scott Refsland, who is the chairman of the Drone Sports Association. The producer, that entity produces the Drone Nationals, which I attended in New York, the Drone Worlds, which just happened in Hawaii. And excuse me?
It's happening in October.
Oh, it's happening in October. Great. It hasn't happened yet. So people can scoot their way over to gorgeous Hawaii and watch this event.
Yeah, where else would be the most perfect epic location to go have a nice race?
That's phenomenal, Scott. I'm so glad that you're here with us. Where in Hawaii are the Worlds taking place?
They're on the island of Oahu, and we actually found that the Jurassic Park backlot Hawaii movie set was actually in just north of Oahu, or Honolulu, about 40 minutes. And it has these beautiful 1,200-foot cliffs on either side. I think everybody can recognize that from any version of Jurassic Park or Jurassic World that you've seen. And so when we saw that like we were like, yep, that's the place we need to have it in.
Oh, that's going to be spectacular. Governor's Island was gorgeous enough. That was quite a venue for your nationals as well. So I'm so glad that you've been able to join us here today. I got so interested in drone sports when I attended the Nationals, which was just a wonderfully professionally put on event. I was really impressed with all the work you guys did and how this is a real sport. And it's a real sport in its infancy, but I could definitely see that even in its infancy, it's got a lot of appeal, not just for people who want to spectate, but people who want to participate. Drone Sports Association deal with anything other than drone racing? You stay away from the combat drones and things, or do you?
You know, that's an interesting question. And we did a rebrand about 3, 4, 5 months ago because we really were looking at is it drone racing or drone sports more what we want to do? Because I don't know if you've ever seen the ones that I did, the FPV Paradise Tour, which I took everybody through Hawaii when we were doing our scouting trips for the Worlds. And we did things like we created what's called now cliff surfing or cliff diving, where you dive down, you know, sheer cliffs and that kind of stuff. And so that was first part of our look at drone sports and not necessarily just racing. And so like if you look at freestyle is not necessarily racing. It's more of a sport. And so we updated our name to Drone Sports Association instead of Rotor Sports or any other name, because we really were looking at the gambit of what's coming up in the next, you know, 10 years. What's the next decade going to bring as far as drone sports?
Right. And just so people understand the legitimacy of racing in particular and the other sports that are developing sort of in tandem with it as drone technology continues to evolve. ESPN and the Discovery Channel have both covered drone racing events. They've covered the Nationals live. I assume they're going to cover the Worlds live. Is that true?
Yes. Or we're going to be doing a 1 hour content on there. We're still deciding on whether we want to do the live stream just yet.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that really struck me in attending this and seeing it firsthand was something that my friend Keith Stryer mentioned while we were there, and that is that this parallel between drone racing and really, really high speed auto racing, whether it's the IRL or Formula One or what have you, that there's a lot of incubation of technology that happens in that sort of extreme racing setting that that envelopes that get pushed, et cetera, that then wind up seeing applications in other areas. And the whole tie-in with virtual reality and augmented reality and drone racing seems a very ripe area for that to happen, not to mention just the technology that goes into the vehicles themselves. For someone who hasn't seen, for someone who's never even heard of drone racing before, and I assume we have some watching and listening to us right now, can you explain how VR and possibly AR tie in with the sport, the different ways that happens?
So my favorite little soundbite that I say is that I have a PhD in virtual reality, and I got it in 2001. I've been in VR since 1987. So if you put the numbers together, I've been around a really long time. And what I like to say is that it took me about 30 years in one drone race to experience true virtual reality. And my definition of virtual reality is that when you put on your goggles, you're not here anymore. You're there. You're in the altered reality or the perceived reality of where you are. And when I tried FPV flying for the very first time, I got vertigo. My hands were sweating. Because I was in the air, I was 100 feet up in the air, I was going 30 miles an hour, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to fall out of the air. And I literally felt like I was going to fall out of the air. And so it really took a lot of might for me to suppress all of those fear of heights to, you know, whatever people experience. And once I started understanding what the greater impact of what this meant was, everybody in there, I don't know if I've ever met any one human that's never had the dream of flight or the out-of-body experience that we all talk about as humans. And what it is that it's so inherently attractive to the younger generations, because it's giving our younger generations a chance to be a superhero. They can leap trees in a single bound by flying. And so it's literally giving the next generation this freedom that they're getting of being able to be not just earthbound, but now they can be a bird and they can fly it. And it's giving them superpowers. And so in this kind of new area of sports in general, we have this kind of tabling off effect of what's going on in traditional stick and ball sports. Even in the NASCAR or in the racing industries, there's an inward bound look at how the technology is going, because it's getting now to, well, if your airframe is 2 millimeters off, then, you know, then you're disqualified, because there's no innovation that's going on to it anymore. And what drone racing does is, suddenly, because it's this brand new sport, it's brand new innovation, and it's being built by a bunch of IT people and computer tech nerds who love iteration. They love getting something new, and all of them have at least 3D printers in their garage running all the parts and stuff like that. So it's outpacing the innovation of what even the industry can handle at the moment. And it literally is a garage type of experience. So what's really interesting is we're getting this three-pronged perfect storm happening. We've got this love of racing, because you get two of anything together, two cars, two drones, and you've got a race. You've got the esports kind of thing happening. And then you've got this virtual reality and augmented reality kind of thing. And all of these are triple-digit growth areas. And so for me, the easiest way I can explain to you why I think the virtual reality and augmented reality is going to be the vehicle that to really propel that is going to be compelling content like drone racing. Because drone racing has one big Achilles heel, and it is that when you watch drone racing as a spectator, it's like watching gnats in a football field flying around and who's first. You can't you can't see it. And so it doesn't come alive until you sit in the cockpit with the first-person view goggles, and you sit in the drone and race in over all the obstacles and the courses on the course, and then you're flying as if you are the pilot or if you are the pilot in this case and piloting it, then you're flying it as if you're in the cockpit. So there is no difference. You can't tell whether you're piloting, you know, a little tiny drone or a big drone. They all perform pretty much the same. So this is where drone racing is ripe for augmented reality and virtuality. I see you got some clips in there. So all of these would be first-person view of how you would experience a race. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with things like sports vision that like Larry Ellison innovated with the America's Cup, because it's sort of the same thing where you got a bunch of yachts out in the middle of nowhere. Well, how do you tell which is which and who's who? And so they innovated this GPS system that goes over top of it, tracks all the boats in where they are in location, and then puts data overlays over top of them. So wherever they float, they're actually this data overlay going, hey, this is the American boat. You know, this is the Oracle boat. This is the Australian boat. And so suddenly it gives you these rich data overlays over top of all this stuff. So this is where we've been heading on this, is that from a spectator experience, now we get all these rich data overlays to show who's in first and how they can do this. Now, what's really interesting is that the younger generations, they're change agents. And like the Pokemon Go thing, the Hunger Games, if you look at the trend of what's going, nobody wants to sit and watch a passive game anymore. And this is why, you know, stick and ball sports, because they're very traditionally, you have a beer and you sit on your sofa and you watch. Well, esports is pushing it into being participatory sports. And so what drone racing is, because there is no rules and regulations of drone racing just yet, if we wanted to overlay data that has collision detection to physical and virtual, we can. So for an example, like I could put an asteroid field in the middle of a physical race course that's a digital overlay on it. And then if I say, hey, pilots, all the spectators, you want to vote for an asteroid field in the middle of this course? And everybody goes, yeah, let's do it. Suddenly this asteroid appears in there and pilots have to navigate around it. And if a physical pilot crashes into that virtual obstacle, I can throw that physical airframe out of the air. So what it's doing is it's pushing us into this boundaries of the next generation of Pokemon Go, but on a much higher, more sophisticated layer.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. And I want to drill down on something you mentioned just a moment ago, since we're a show that looks at the intersection of technology and law. We've been talking a lot about the new commercial drone rules that the FAA has just announced at the end of August, and comparing and contrasting them to the hobby rules that existed a little before. And what you just said is you don't think drone racing fits into either of those, and that the FAA hasn't addressed it directly yet. Is that pretty much the position of drone racing at this point?
All I can say is it's drama, drama, drama.
Indeed.
Somebody's making a bunch of money on litigation right now, for sure. I bet it's Jim Williams at Denton's. That's who it is now.
At the same time, though, judging by the, you know, Part 107 rules that were released, I mean, FPV flying was pretty strictly written out. I mean, they were not, you know, it wasn't an omission. You know, they said like FPV flying, you need a license, you need a pilot's license unless you are, you know, complying with these other rules they didn't say. So, I mean, surely you guys are thinking about that on, you know, on some level.
Yeah, so let me give you a little bit of background on what's going on. So my second day job is to work with the FAA. And my third day job is to work with the FCC. Because both of those pieces for drone racing and drone sports is out of compliance. And if you don't have a ham radio license, you're out of compliance. You're breaking a federal law. You know, ham radio is a legacy format. In fact, I bumped into a bunch of ham radio operators at a race one time, and I said, oh, you got right away because you have the permit to fly here. And they're like, well, what frequency are you flying on? And I'm like, well, 5,600 to 5,900, like, ah, we haven't been there for years because everybody at Best Buy has bought non-compliant stuff. And so we've skipped off. We've never been in that one. I'm like, well, okay, that's why FCC is not enforcing those laws. For the FAA is a different kettle of fish, because what they're trying to do is define, they're doing their job really well because they are our safety bulldog, and that's what they're trying to do ultimately. They're not trying to be the good guy or the bad guy. They're trying to enforce safety in the airspace, in the national airspace. And so I get that. And where where the conflict is happening is that what is that definition of it? And so there was, you know, as you guys all know, all the different pieces that have been written over the last couple of years, since 2012 and 2014, they've been trying to keep up in fire mode with all the proliferation of stuff. And drone racing is no exception. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. drone racing has been the little black sheep of the whole thing because we've had Brendan Schulman in battling for DJI's rights, for commercial ventures, for, you know, the 3D robotics guys. Anybody's had a budget to put a lobbyist in Capitol Hill. All the rules are written for those people specifically so that, you know, like when I look at 107, and I've been talking with FAA about 107 a lot, I said, 107 part 37B says, it's a yield the right of way. And I said, drone racing is about crashing. It's like, we have to, it is a crash.
It's like
That's
NASCAR.
The thrilling part.
Right.
And so then they went, oh, well, yeah, this was written before we knew that we were going to be, putting drone racing underneath this umbrella of 107. And so I go, well, the part 37B is going to be a full stop. And they go, yeah, let's think about that one for a second. And then they said, well, if it's your intention to avoid collision at all costs, then you can do it. And I said, well, of course it is, because if you crash and you don't win, you don't get the prize money. So of course we're going to be trying to avoid crashes. And then they go, okay, we'll give your blessing on that one. So it's been a really interesting thing. The FPV one is a big problem.
I remember sitting in on a couple of the streams of the multi-stakeholder rulemaking sessions for the drone regulations over the past year. And I mean, I can't help but feel like it was just it never got anywhere. You know, it was mired. And, you know, we have these rules. I feel like the FPV argument got brought up before. Do you have any idea what was going on, why FPV is sort of singled out?
So FPV has nefarious beginnings. And this is a little bit of a carryover in the feeling with Raphael Perker, aka Trappy, who, if you take him offline, that dude's fantastically cool. Like, you just gotta love Trappy. But Trappy's always been one of these, like, I'm gonna stick my fingers up your nose on both nostrils just to get up to you. And did all these things like flying over, you know, Golden Gate to, you know, because it's sensational, it's the YouTube thing. But he really got up FAA's nose. And what it did is it revealed the nefarious side of FPV being used beyond line of sight to carry bombs, to blow up people, it suddenly everybody dramatized it. And of course, you know, the news people, they really loved it as well. And so what happened is that we as an industry said, wait a minute, we're still flying line of sight and we're FPV and we're not carrying bombs and it's below 55 pounds. It's below 15 pounds and it's 750 grams. And wait a minute, don't kill us because we're actually abiding by the rules of AMA and traditional aircraft. And the FAA, because we didn't have a lobbyist in there, we're just a bunch of nerds, right? And we all have day jobs. So we didn't have the big lobbyist in there helping us define what FPV did. And so, unfortunately, we got locked into that whole FPV is a bad thing because it's miles and miles and miles beyond line of sight, and it's all these kind of nefarious things. And so this is why we're now cleaning up all that mess of having to kind of circle back around and say, wait a minute, there is another use before a case of FPV beyond that, of extra distance of line of sight. So this is where the FAA is kind of acknowledging that drone racing is a legitimate sport, and it is because the VSPNs put their nickel in the slot now twice with Drone Racing League, DR1 and Mountain Dew. I know, I'm sure Warner Brothers is going to be coming out with something fairly soon too. So there's a lot of movement towards FPV racing, and it's a legitimate sport with good cases. And we even had FAA as observers, official observers at the 2015 Drone Nationals in Sacramento. And in fact, they were so satisfied they actually left early because they're like, "Hey, you're running it safely to the T's and you're doing it well." So the 2016 Drone Nationals literally was the second iteration out of looking at what drone racing does. And so this is what nobody really knew about what Drone Nationals was in New York City was. Is it literally was the test case for the FAA to officially recognize drones racing and drone sports as an accredited racing body that is going to be on the same level Red Bull Air Racing. And that just happened. And so that's what's super exciting where we are. And so what we're going through now is that FPV Racing is going through all the certificate of waivers and all the other pieces that make drone racing go on there. Unfortunately, there isn't a pathway now just yet to take the amateur in there, because their ruling is on the the 1112 or 1111 section. Which one is that? The 14 CFR Part 91. That ruling is they are going to enforce it. So that's going to create a problem for the amateur side of AMA.
Right. Could you expand on? Yeah, I wanted to, first of all, before we drill down deeper on that, just get your take on whether drone racing at the level that I saw with the pilots who came to New York and competed, do you consider them hobbyists or do you consider them something else?
So in the eyes of the FAA, the mm-hmm. FAA is defining professional races as, did you derive income off your spectators and did you derive income off your broadcast? It's mm-hmm. not about if you got a purse or not.
But what if you're a pilot? How do you make that determination for yourself? If you go and compete and don't win anything, you're not getting any income, but you're certainly in this in a committed way.
Correct. So it's still in the gray area, and the Nationals is run as an official amateur sanctioned event by the AMA because there wasn't any other. We couldn't even fit within the 333, as a matter of fact, because we actually applied for our 333. We did all the exemptions, and we still couldn't do it for a couple of things. One of them, there's no return to home on a racing drone. Number two, mm-hmm. there's not even 3 minutes of battery time in a battery, and you have to have 5 minutes reserve. So, right. And there's no geofencing, so that's why 333 never even did. So what we had to do is to skirt the boundaries of the 333, because even though we have professionals like Steele Davis and Chad Nowak and Umagod, or any of the other pieces that people have quit their day jobs and now are professionals, mm-hmm. they still couldn't call themselves professionals, because as soon as you called yourself professional, you couldn't mm-hmm. fit within the 333, and therefore you had to do what DRL did, which is fly completely inside. Because wow. DRL did come out and say to them, they came out and said, we are professional, but then that just chopped they chopped off everything and they have to fly inside.
Right. So what about like sponsorships outside. Then? Wouldn't that mean that, like, how do these athletes be athletes? You know, how do they get sponsorships if they're, you know, having to claim?
Yeah. Well, so this is the little area that AMA has been skirting for years. And even Bob mm-hmm. Brown won't tell you officially, but Bob Brown's supported by Futaba and a couple other things. He derives income off of his sponsorships. They pay for his way to get places. They pay for, you know, those things. And even in the traditional RC world, they've had pilots that derive $2,000 to $3,000 a month of income based upon their sponsors to go around and showcase product. And right. so the issue that has never been an issue yet is there's never been a paying spectator or paying broadcast at an AMA event. It's been amateur. There hasn't been the mm-hmm. volume for people to understand that this is a commercial. So it's only because drone racing's meteoric rise suddenly into it that's hit the radar of, oh, what is professional and what is not. And so
right. And right just now, to clarify for our listeners before we go too much further, DRL that you referred to is Drone Racing League, and they do all their racing indoors. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Because they cannot fit within the FAA rule set of professional racing. Now, they will now that there is Part 107, but up to this point in Part 107, they could not.
Got it. Just wondering what advice you would give, because what I saw at this event in New York were tons and tons of people who jumped on the ferries and come out as a family to watch the event, and kids whose eyes were huge looking at all the gear and deciding, you know, how they could get their hands on a 3D printer and start making parts mm-hmm. and get into this arena. And, you know, you started to talk about the amateurs being in a gray area here. Obviously, your sport needs those amateurs to be able to continue to grow and add from the bottom so that you have Correct. Competitors in the future. What would be your advice for those people right now as far as, you know, as far as I can tell, just simply picking up one of these drones and starting to fly it, they've got tons of stop signs in front of them under either set of FAA rules. So how do you tell them to proceed?
So, yeah, that's a really great question. And I think that we're still ironing that out. But the short answer is that go to Amazon.com, buy a $35 drone and fly it in your, in your living room.
Right.
And I do tell people that. And then you can get the little FPV, the first person view version. That's Horizon Hobby's got a great little blade, little micro. You can fly around your house and under your, you know, scare your cat and, you know, and have a great time in it. As soon as you step outside and you use FPV as of Monday a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. that's now illegal.
Yeah.
Full stop. It's completely illegal. AMA is going to tell you differently. FAA, according to Part 112, let me see, I just got an email from them. It's PL 112-95 special rule for model aircraft. That one is the one that's the big grill in the room. That's the one that FAA has not enforced, but they didn't write it. Congress said, yes, this is it. We're giving our blessing, and that's it. And so as soon as they enforce it, that means that it's null and void. It's a bad view for the FPV industry in general because it full stops us. Mm-hmm. The only way you can get around that now is to go get your 107.
Right. But even then, don't you need an exemption for FPV?
You need a remote pilot in command addition to the 107, correct?
Ah, got it.
Mm. Yeah, what's exactly entailed in that process? Does that basically make it, you know, impossible for, you know, amateurs that want to do FPV flying?
So this is the fallout of us having to deal with the long-range FPV stuff. It's because it scared the crap out of everybody from a homeland security standpoint to terrorism. You know, hey, we could fly a, you know, remote pilot for, you know. And, of course, the military's been doing it for years and years, so they understand what the ramp, you know, the implications of flying well beyond line of sight means. And so I think this is now the extra heavy, cautious fallout that we've had to it. So it means that there's going to be extra litigation. It means that there's going to be, I mean, I'm sure AMA can't just roll over and say, no, we agree to this, because they have entire brand. I mean, they're basing their entire future or a substantial future of theirs to be, you know, model aircraft flyers to be FPV racing. I mean, this is the fax machine that can't be put back in the box. It's happened. And so we have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. You know, my strong words back to the FAA was, well, it's great for you to say that you have to have a Part 107 to fly FPV, but and we're actually, you know, as far as my race in Hawaii, we are actually going to be accredited FAA race event. And so we have all the pieces in place in order to facilitate that whole thing. So I'm not concerned about us being shut down, but it means that What I asked of them, as I said, well, it's great that all the pilots, when they come to my event, are going to be included under your Part 107. But how do they practice to get there? How do they mm-hmm. get into the, mm-hmm. the, you know, the park right next door if they don't have a 107? How do they practice? So these are the big question marks that we all have. It's like, you know, the early days, it's going to have some setbacks in here.
Right. What are you doing about the age restriction, if anything?
So for... So the idea that we've been working with FAA and look, FAA is very, proactive towards drone racing. They think it's a great thing. They love it. They're, what we've been doing is using all the Reno Air Racing, Red Bull Air Racing. We've been using all those as the model in order to say, well, what does drone racing look like in the future? And so we've been taking all of those models and then rebuilding all of those pieces to it. What we started going down is like, what are the waiverable pieces and what are the not waiverable pieces in 107? And part of those has been like, okay, you have to be 16 years older in order to get a Part 107. I said, well, that's a barrier. How do we deal with that? Because currently Minchon's 14, We have a 12-year-old kid coming out of Colombia.
I played enough Call of Duty to know that the 13-year-olds are going to be the best FPV flyers. I know.
Absolutely. So what we came up with was the waiver that says our flight deck operator, who is in command, he has a Part 107. He or she has a Part 107. He or she has a remote pilot in command certification on top of that, and then has a certification from us that says it's very much like the competitive director that AMA releases for all their competitive events people, that would say, yes, this person is able to run a flight deck of X amount of pilots, 10 pilots, 20 pilots on the line, however it goes to. And whoever's on the sticks, it doesn't matter if they have a Part 107, doesn't matter if they're 16, it doesn't matter whether they're from an international country, as long as the person that's in command has the Part 107 and the remote pilot's in command and a certification, then you can run it. So that's when I'm like, whew, okay, that's how we can dodge that bullet.
Right. And do you feel like the rules that we're struggling with here in the U.S. and the ones that you're trying to hammer out with the FAA, even as we speak, that those are the most restrictive in the world? And so if you're complying with those, you're going to be okay in Dubai and wherever else you're going to be flying? Or is it just a mess wherever you go and you're going to have to comply region by region with whatever the local restrictions are?
And can I piggyback on that? Are we seeing, are we seeing the possibility of America regulating out its own drone racing industry that maybe other countries are popping up? You know, it seems like drone racing might take off in Dubai.
Right. So, well, it has.
Put that on you. Exactly.
Well, that's a really great question. And I'm hoping that, because when I asked the FAA, I said, what you're saying is if you enforce Part 107 on every single drone racer, FPV racer, you just killed the entire sport. And they said, well, it is what it is. That's what the law says. And I said, so what's that mean? And suddenly now we have to have a lobbying body and we have to get Ready-Made RC to Lumineer to get FPV to A-Main to Hobby King to all those things are suddenly going to have a lobbying body along with FAA, AMA, in order to do that, to change legislation. And they said, yeah, that's pretty much what's going to have to happen. And so, rightfully so, we've had a lot of the online retailers and everybody has been sort of riding this horse for quite a while and enjoying the revenue generation of the stuff. But nobody's really been paying attention to somebody like DJI, who's been in there going like, it's in our best interest to be having somebody on the Hill lobbying for legislation of getting those rules in there. So the rules are very sympathetic towards traditional UAV operators. It's only just been the drone racing industry that's not been in that. And so now it's our time to get up and stand up on the Hill.
Right. I have a couple of questions for you now that the rules are out there and you know how you're kind of navigating them. If these kinds of concerns have come up, whether it matters if the FPV completely seals in your vision or perhaps is more AR oriented, would that make a difference to the FAA? If you're not just seeing the drone's point of view, but you can also see around you and the drone is still within your sight line. I don't know. I just wondered if there's anything to play around with how the FPV works that could appease the FAA. Is that something you've been exploring?
I love your creative thinking. it's a really great one. I think, augmented reality in this traditional case is literally floating data within your physical environment. I'm not sure that it would work in that direction.
Yeah.
What I'm hoping is there are going to be some creative thinkers out there that would be able to, it's already happened. The entire micro business, which you, maybe some of you guys know of called the tiny whoop.
That
all came out
question.
Of the whole thing of 250 grand or less. Well, that overnight, we suddenly had a great FPV business, but now that's being shut down because of the FPV part of it.
Right. So that was my next question. Is there's an article at Wired for anyone who's interested by Scott Gilbertson titled, "Go Ahead, Fly a Tiny Drone. The Man Doesn't Have to Know," and gives some recommendations on tiny, tiny drones that you could fly that don't have to comply. Of course, as soon as you take them outside, I believe you might have other issues despite their weight. But I was wondering if in drone racing, you were considering taking the weight down and if that would make a difference.
Yeah, you know, and there's already been the micro, you know, races, and it's starting. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about maybe doing a micro race in the Worlds because they're super fun, and you know, you can have them inside, and then all pilots are pretty much carrying them around anymore, just because they're, you know, great for, you know, fiddling around in your hotel room or whatever it is. So that is a piece. I think it's still early days, but the definitions that are being interpreted now is literally is that what is model aircraft and model air, you know, RC model flying, what does that mean? And FPV has now been fully taken over by under the FAA auspice and taken completely off the plate of AMA. So this is where the problem it's now kind of stemming is from. That's pretty much killing everything from FPV racing at this point until there is some. The professional side of things actually is starting to get ironed out very quickly because they do see that that's a great one, and there is rules and regulations and certifications and waivers that all fit within what they're doing. It's now up to how does the hobby and the grassroots side of things actually, you know, meet within that piece. That's the big question mark dilemma we've got.
Yes. All right, one final question for you, and then you can decide, Scott, whether you'd like to stay on with us. We're going to look at how the Dutch police are using eagles, their eagle counter-drone measure program, how that's been evolving. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned collision avoidance and all of the really cool tech that is built into drones to the extent that some of them you could say even have, you know, with the return to home kind of technology, they have various AI features that might be safety features on the one hand, or might be something that could go wrong, I guess, on the other. But there, as drones get more and more artificially intelligent, is that something that might factor into drone racing as well, where and in a helpful way for you, in that you could incorporate collision avoidance possibly and make the FAA happen? Is that anything that's happening?
So we have one race that's out there. It's called human vision versus machine vision, and it's the artificially intelligent. Who's going to be the faster racer? And it's not plotting by waypoints. It's plotting by machine vision. And I've seen some very interesting pieces from, like, out of MIT that's doing collision avoidance and detection and, you know, that kind of stuff, which is pretty amazing stuff. I guess this is the interesting piece that we're in. And, you know, like, I talk with NASA's UTM guys all the time about the innovation of where we're going in drone racing, because drone racing literally is the spear tip of innovation across all those pieces. And and I think that this is what the FAA is very interested in. It's seeing that innovation really, you know, move quite quickly. And so we'll probably see in the next couple of years all sorts of different kinds of things. And collision detection is probably going to be a part of it, whether it's, you know, manned or unmanned. I think the result of what I see the best thing that drone racing contributes to is some of the best pilots, the most elite pilots in the world that can fly close proximity, that actually can fly for the most part either visual line of sight or by FPV. And we're going to have an entire industry that's up here in the next decade that's going to be the unmanned traffic, like NASA's UTM or the Universal Traffic Management is dealing with all the traffic that's going to be in the national airspace. And that's anything from the Amazon Prime delivery to autonomous taxis. You know, Google stuff is only going to be on cars for so long before it's in the air. And so we're going to have all of these fail safes and pieces that go on the back of it. And we're going to need a whole set of pilots that could gain control over an autonomous vehicle that is out of control. And so that's the exciting thing that I see, is that, you know, pilots that are drone racing pilots today are fantastic candidates and career candidates for autonomous drone pilots or those things of tomorrow, because they have those skill sets. So it's still the wild, wild west, and it's a very exciting place to be.
Yes.
That's utterly fascinating. I don't think that we've gotten the chance to talk much on the show about UTM. I actually first heard about it last night. Could you either tell us a little bit more about that, go a little more into depth about the system that you're talking about that NASA is developing?
Yeah, you know, and you'd have to go talk to PK. PK is the one who drives it. I think he speaks at all, like Interdrones, and you know, he's part of that whole AUVSI. Like, if you look at AUVSI, you could even type in NASA UTM, Universal Traffic Management. It's super cool. Like, it's the next generation of, you know, what better agency to have, you know, help out with our national airspace traffic control than NASA. You know, it's like, it's super geeky and super cool, but it blows my brain out. It's like way above my pay grade. But.
Right. Awesome. Well, we'll try to check it out then.
Well, maybe the FAA will incorporate a rule that you have to call NASA before you fly your drone. Because right now they want you calling the airport if you're within 5 miles of it. So
exactly.
Yes. All right.
So San Diego is out.
Yes. Scott, this has been so fun. If you have a few more minutes, I think you might be interested. You've probably already seen it in the footage of the Dutch police and how they're responding to unauthorized drones. Do you have a few secs to hang on with
us? I do, yeah. In fact, you know, what's interesting is I talked to, I'm going to have to turn on my computer. Hopefully it didn't die. When I was in Dubai for the Dubai race, I bumped into the Falconer for all of the shakes. And he took me out. He was actually using single wings to train his falcons. And when I said, well, what about the, you know, police using that? And he was incredibly against it. He thought it was pretty bad. But
all right, well, let's see what they're doing. We've covered this on the show before. They released a new video this week. They've had a bunch of eagles in training. I think they're getting the eagles from the U.S. And now they've gotten to the point. Here they are. They're sort of doing a training exercise for an eagle right here. They're showing some public official making a public sort of meet and greet. And then, oh my gosh, no, there's a drone or there's a danger or something. His Secret Service or protector is whisking him away. And now we've got this somehow unwelcome drone. I don't know if it's just taking photos or perhaps it has more nefarious purposes, but there it is. It's been identified, and they release the eagle. Off it goes, and boom, there goes a very nice $1,500 DJI Phantom taken down. The eagles are, I guess, trained, if the drone is small enough, to carry the drone away and take it to a spot that is designated by the police. It seems like this one might be too much for this eagle. It's just sort of containing it. And for those interested in the eagle's safety, I've read that they are developing protective coverings for their claws. Right now, their claws don't seem to be taking any damage. Their feathers don't seem to be taking any damage from the rotor. You could see the drone came out much the worse for wear on that encounter. The eagle seems to be just fine, but they are definitely paying attention to the health and welfare of their feathered officers there. So this is the only police force in the world to date that is using eagles in this way, but you can see that it's quite effective. But there in Dubai, the Sheikh's Falconer was not a fan. Is that right, Scott?
He was not a fan, and it's mostly because the, you know, the eagles or whoever the predator is that they can't see the props, if they do see the props, then they would basically, because they actually look for the head and the neck is where they would go at it. And so, you know, obviously everybody's like, well, what is the safety and welfare? And if you just notice right there, he actually killed the props from spinning because the propellers actually just got down. It landed with the propellers up and they were still spinning.
Oh, I see. So they did not have the propellers spinning when the eagle was taking it down?
Correct, yeah. So the issue is that the predator, the eagle, literally is going now to try to eat it. Because and so, you know, he's going to grab onto that, and now you've got, you know, spinning Kintu knives that are not that great. So, you know, he was very concerned because his whole purpose is that he's taking, you know, the safe and welfare of his birds, and so he was pretty much adamantly against that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, and understandably so.
You should
have
him on the show. He could give you a better counterpoint than I can because, you know, I was just more fascinated on, like, how he was actually using single wings to train his falcons, because a lot of falcons, because there aren't a lot of prey still left in the world because it's been overhunted, that he was using drones in order to get athletically fit a lot of his Falcons because they, you know, he could fly them around a lot longer and build them up athletically.
It's like a treadmill for the Falcon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Pray they can't catch. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Scott, I can't tell you how much we appreciate your joining us today and all your insights. We will keep our fingers crossed that there's more clarity in the future on the regulatory front. We know that you're actively working toward that day by day. So
thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Yes.
Very much appreciate your time. And folks, if you haven't already, check out the Drone Sports Association and maybe catch a race. They're really quite fun to take in, especially in person when you can do the FPV viewing. So best of luck, Scott.
Thank you very much. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Take care. Well, that was super interesting. So glad you could join us. We do have a second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, who I would like to thank. And that is Wealthfront. You invest for the long term for your or your family's health financially. But trying to do it yourself, especially the right way, is complex and time consuming, can be really confusing. Luckily, there's Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees between 1% and 3% of what they manage. With Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, and no hidden fees. That's less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. With Wealthfront's new portfolio review, you can see if your portfolio is at risk, how diversified your investments are, what you're losing to fees, even minimize your taxes. You can get started investing today with as little as $500. It only takes a few minutes to sign up. And then Wealthfront goes right to work, monitoring your portfolios around the clock, taking action as soon as the opportunity arises. Wealthfront is transparent and accessible. You can view and track all your accounts in one place. Wealthfront can track both your Wealthfront and non-Wealthfront bank and brokerage accounts, and they'll provide you a summary of all your assets in one place. You can also see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard, on your desktop, or with their mobile app. Wealthfront's process is based on Nobel Prize winning academic research and the best investment practices. We've heard from many TWiT fans who have used Wealthfront and love how they can diversify their portfolios and buy stocks from in-demand companies like Apple and Amazon and Facebook, all commission-free. Wealthfront recently introduced their 529 college savings plan, allowing you to invest after-tax dollars, much like a Roth IRA, and save for your child or grandchild's higher education expenses. Wealthfront manages almost $3 billion in client assets, and it's growing rapidly every day. What are you waiting for? Invest in your future today with Wealthfront. Visit wealthfront.com/twill to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your profile. And just for TWiT listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Join the many TWiT fans who have seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today at wealthfront.com/twill. Thank you so much, Wealthfront, for your support of This Week in Law. And I think we need at least our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And it's going to be bolting or dabbing, getting back into the story that we were just about to delve deeper into before we brought Scott Refslin on the show. So now that we have established bolting and dabbing and the distinction between them, Mike, tell us more about the trademark ramifications of bolting.
Okay. So this is, I'd say, another example of a star athlete taking advantage, and I mean that in a good way, of his image and images associated with him to promote a commercial product or service. So Usain Bolt is very well known in the Olympics and otherwise when he competes or after he competes in doing his Bolt dance, which is, as we talked about, similar to the dab. But he actually has registered trademarks associated with the silhouette of him doing his very well-known dab pose. Now, some may think, well, hold on, can you really protect that as a trademark? And the answer is yes, it's protected, federally registered, with respect to certain products and services. So Other examples that we've seen in the past, of course, would be the very famous Jumpman, the image of Michael Jordan that is a protected trademark of Nike. And that, of course, is used with respect to a whole host of goods and services, goods primarily by Nike, including or primarily Air Jordan.
Got it. So, Emery, you thought this was pretty incredible that trademark would be implicated here. Tell us why.
Yeah, well, okay. So what first came to mind is the idea of choreography is something that can be copyrighted. And we talked about a case earlier last year, I want to say, with, you know, for example, a guy that was trying to copyright certain yoga moves. Yes, right. Mm-hmm. Copyrighted
Bikram.
Different yoga routines. And they said that that, you know, was not copyrightable. So, you know, my idea that my first thought is that, well, just a pose clearly can't be copyrighted, but it could be trademarked. And obviously, Mike was saying that, you know, in this case, it's really the silhouette of the person's pose that is the actual trademark used on products and goods. So, mm-hmm. for example, if I was, you know, wanted to have a commercial for my business, you know, Emery's, you know, goods, and I posed in front of the picture, you know, doing the bolt or whatever it's called, you know, it's not likely that that would be a trademark violation. But if I did start like making a silhouette of my picture of myself doing the bolt and put it on products, then it might be a trademark. It would be more likely a trademark violation. Is that basically right, Mike?
That's right. I mean, one of the registrations covers all-purpose sport bags, including athletic bags, backpacks, suitcases, wallets, leather cases for keys, toiletry bags, travel bags, things of this nature. So, you know, it's not like Usain Bolt owns that particular image for any use under the sun. It would be he has exclusive trademark rights with respect to that image used in conjunction with the registered goods. So, you know, we see this all the time, particularly now. Marshawn Lynch is, you know, very well known in the industry for taking advantage of certain phrases. Beast Mode, I believe, is a registration I think we've talked about on the show before that his oft-quoted saying that he made off the cuff at the Super Bowl, I'm just here so I won't get fined, that's also a registered trademark that he uses.
All right, but that – so in that case, you know, I'm just here so I don't get fined was like totally unique. Could you give a quick refresher for maybe our listeners that aren't as aware of, you know, the ins and outs of trademark law as you are that is there any kind of originality requirement for a trademark? I mean, because like Beast Mode, I mean, I'm thinking like that's nothing like that. Beast Mode does, you know, definitely predates him saying that. And just like this Usain Bolt pose, you know, the pose predates it. So, you know, even like I would think a silhouette of that pose has probably been done before.
Yeah, you're right, Emery. There is a pretty stark contrast between the concept of copyright and trademark in this respect. So, of course, copyright requires some sort of originality, a dash of creativity, whereas the standard for trademark protection, any word, name, symbol, or other device can act as a trademark if you use it in conjunction with goods or services to differentiate those goods and services from somebody else's in the marketplace. So there's no requirement of originality. It simply has got to function as a source identifier. And Mr. Bolt was able to convince the trademark office, and I'm sure rightfully so, that this particular image, when used in conjunction with the goods – in the registration would be sufficiently distinctive for him to claim trademark rights.
All right. So I think you guys have given us also our second MCLE passphrase for the show, which is going to be silhouette due diligence, making sure that if you are striking that pose, that you're doing it in a way that doesn't infringe trademark. We're going to get to our animal selfie of the week for you this week, which is not an actual animal and not in an actual selfie, but I think you'll see where I'm going when I explain to you what it is. So So in a show where we've talked a lot about drones and drone racing and seen the Dutch police's pet eagles taking down drones, I figured we could do our animal selfie of the week as something that could take an animal selfie and might be anthropomorphic in nature. And this is what they're calling the pet drone. That is a crowdfunded drone out of Zurich that is on a leash. And it is a small camera drone that you keep on a tether. And it looks like it can go quite high on its tether. But part of the thinking that this company has in mind is that by keeping it on a tether, and this is something we should have asked Scott, maybe you should tether all the racing drones and see how that goes. By keeping it on a tether, it actually takes itself out of, and I haven't researched this in great depth, and I'm not sure how the FAA would feel about it, but I think this company is banking on, by keeping it on a tether, it's treated like a kite as opposed to a UAV, and that of course, the FAA has various restrictions on uses of kites as well, but I think that they are somewhat different and presumably more lenient than some of the drone rules. In the article here from the Daily Mail, the UK, they have a little sidebar that says, rule abiding, the drone can be regulated as a kite under FAA UAS unmanned aerial systems guidelines. So, something to bear in mind when you need to take your animal selfies or if you consider a drone on a leash, a pet itself. Secondly, our tip of the week is going to be a couple of things you can look into if you are interested in making your social media experience on Twitter a more palatable time for you. There's a great article in TechCrunch that I encourage people to check out. And it highlights a couple of tools. I haven't used them myself, but I just encourage you to check them out. They could be useful. They are called Block Together and No More. No More says it provides the ability to share and mute and block lists among followers and the entire Twitter graph, creating a system-wide shared blacklist that anyone can subscribe to. And Block Together is sort of in similar vein. It says it will reduce the burden of blocking when many accounts are attacking you or when a few accounts are attacking a lot of people in a community. And users can also share blocked accounts so that folks can indeed block together. It also has options that let users auto block accounts that are less than 7 days old or have 15 or fewer followers. That seems like it would be very handy. Our resource of the week is if you are one of those people who is brave and wants to count on the fact that Scott Refslin and the FAA and others involved in drone sports are going to figure out the actual legal status of amateurs, there is a great guide at bestdronefortthejob.com. It also has a separate, a completely separate camera drone buying guide if that is really your thing. But if you're interested in drone racing, I encourage you to check out their Getting Into Drone Racing guide, which has everything from how to build a drone yourself. It has a link to very well-known drone racing pilot Sharpu's 30-minute how-to video on building your own racing drone. Covers what components you need to have, covers how you can do it yourself, how you can have someone do it for you, what's necessary and what's optional, how to practice, train, and compete. What it doesn't address is the sort of legal thicket that we addressed on the show. But if that hasn't deterred you, the gear is out there and available, and you can fly at your own risk at this point. So wanted to let you know that that resource is there for you. I wanted to thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This Week in Law. It's been a really fun and interesting interlude. Mike Keyes from the Dorsey firm in Seattle. So great to chat with you again.
Denise, as always, great to be with you and Emery. And that was terrific to have Scott today. Very fascinating discussion.
Yeah, yeah, I was fascinated too. And Emery, it sounds like you might have some more ideas of drone and counter-drone people we might want to ask on the show. Also, getting someone involved in NASA UTM would be really interesting.
I'm putting it on the list.
Yay.
So hopefully, I know that some of our listeners may be getting a little tired of drone news, so we'll try to spread that out a bit. But yeah, hopefully we'll be able to get some counter-drone experts and maybe some UTM experts on the show eventually. Either way, I think this is exactly the kind of stuff that originally made me tune into Twill, so I'm happy to be here.
Right. You were telling us before the show you had just had a conversation with some folks about, what are the most disruptive technologies out there. I think that UAVs would readily fall into that category. So it's why we keep coming back to it. Plus, as we've gone over ever since the new rules came out on August 29th, it's far from super clear on the
Absolutely.
Legal front right
yeah.
now. So
yeah.
Trying to keep you as
Frontier
informed and advised as it's possible to be on that front. We record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. You can join us by going to twit.tv/live at that time. But if you can't make it, head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our entire archive of shows is there for you. And we encourage you to check them out. We encourage you to get in touch with us between the shows. Emery is Emery at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Please email us or find us on Twitter. All of our Twitter handles have been up throughout the show. The show has our Facebook page and Google Plus page as well if you want to get in touch with us on those formats as well. Tell us what you liked, what you're not liking, who you think we should talk to, other very transformative technologies you think that we should be paying attention to that we're not. We definitely want to try. We've done space law shows in the past. We'd love to try and do a VR law show. So we're
definitely
incubating that and figuring out who should be invited on for such a panel. If you have ideas, please let us know. Other than that, we'll see you next time on This Week in Law. Take care.